Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guests today are Summer Mathis, new editor of City Metric and currently based in New York. My second guest is Adriana Campello, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Salvador in Brazil. And my third guest is Katrin Enenkel, Senior Analyst at the Centre for Cities, but a former resident and worker in Berlin, Germany. Welcome all to City Talks. Great to have you all. Our topic today is how cities in general, but we're going to start with thinking about New York, Salvador and Berlin in particular, have been impacted by and are responding to the COVID-19 crisis. It's a big remit, but given your current jobs and your previous experiences, you're ideally placed to give us a kind of panoramic view as well as any detail on the specific places that you are currently working in and living in. So, Summer, can I start with you? Obviously, you're based in and around New York, epicenter of the COVID crisis, particularly in the emergency phase. Can you just give us your general reflections on how the city was impacted and where we are now in terms of coming out of that emergency period into the recovery period? And then I'll come to Adriana and get similar thoughts from her.
Yeah, well, obviously, as you mentioned, New York City was heavily impacted, especially in the first early weeks. The restriction of movement was pretty intense for most of New York City for quite some time. That's starting to change now. We're moving slowly into the early stages of reopening, and in fact, the in reality, the hotspots in the United States have now moved, right? So New York City was the hottest spot for the pandemic for quite some time. But I would say across the board, New Yorkers have been wearing masks. They've been staying inside. They've been avoiding crowds, with some notable exceptions, of course. But we have managed to slow down the spread in New York City at this point. And now in the U.S., the hotspots are in the Sun Belt. They're in Arizona. They're in Florida. They're in Texas. They're in some of the states that moved quite early to reopen, whereas New York City has been very cautious and very careful about reopening so far. So it's been, it's been tough. The first month for, 4 to 6 weeks, in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, it was a scary time. The feeling was that the virus was everywhere. And even just kind of going out on the sidewalks, if you had the sense that there just wasn't enough space for everybody to even run essential errands. The subways have been relatively empty. But as the crisis has moved on and evolved, it's gotten to be a feeling slightly more normal, I would say. There were weeks where I definitely felt uneasy about even going to the grocery store. But these days, most shops have very sensible rules in place to limit the number of people inside. Everyone requires masks. And it does feel a little bit safer to venture out these days than it did, a month or two ago.
And was it a bit of a surprise in terms of how New Yorkers responded to, to the crisis in terms of their willingness to, to do in essentially what the state and what the government were requiring them to do? This is a theme that we've certainly had, I'm sure, elsewhere, but definitely in Britain, there was a concern amongst the scientists in the early stages that the public wouldn't do essentially what they were required to do, which I think was misguided in retrospect, but still.
Well, unfortunately, this has become a big cultural conversation in the U.S. at this point. There are parts of the country where people are refusing to wear masks based on some kind of macho idea of, I'm not afraid. I refuse to wear a mask, and these rules are, infringing on my liberty. But in New York City, no, it doesn't surprise me at all that everyone was willing to follow the guidelines. I think the real issue in New York City was that the guidelines were not clear for quite some time. We got a lot of mixed messages from our city leaders about what was appropriate behavior, especially in the early weeks. So everybody wanted to do the right thing, but the fact that we were getting you know, not clear instructions. The mayor of our city, in fact, really contributed to that, to those mixed messages by saying things that were different from what we were hearing from the scientists. So I think that the real frustration was just not being sure what we were supposed to be doing for quite some time. But no, it doesn't surprise me that New Yorkers were willing to, you know, inconvenience themselves to help each other out. I think there's a pretty decent sense of solidarity among actual residents of New York City, particularly the ones who stayed in the city. There's been a lot of coverage of the fact that the wealthiest New Yorkers all kind of fled to their summer homes and haven't come back. And of course, we have no tourists in the city, like everyone else. So the people who are there are, you know, they're lifelong New Yorkers. They're residents who are not particularly wealthy and don't have another option. And so those of us who have stayed in the city, I think there's a feeling of we're all in this together. We love this city. We want to make this work, and we're going to do what it takes to, you know, to beat this virus and get our city back.
Fantastic. So, Adriana, let's turn to you. Just give us paint a picture of Salvador and the impact that you had, your experience in, and then later on we can talk about recovery phase and where that is and all the rest. But just give us a sense as to what's been going on in the city.
Salvador is a city with almost 3 million people, and it's in a developing country as Brazil. Salvador is not a rich city. So it's a city that we have 1 million more vulnerable people, you know, the term favelas that we now call communities. So at the beginning of the crisis, the mayor was very much concerned with the vulnerable people. So the concern with care became, I would say, the central part of his administration at the moment. So very early, I think on the second week of March, he is starting to take action, especially because the federal government, the central government, they were not taking action. So what happened in Brazil, the mayors and the state governors, they start to take action, you know, to fill that gap. So very early, the mayor decide to close business, to reduce and ask everybody to stay at home, and to reduce the fleet of public transport as well, to avoid people going to many places, close the beaches, it was one thing, but also put together some measures to help these more vulnerable people. So put available grants. The economy in Salvador is very much informal, so it was important to do something for these informal workers. So we start to organize some grants to provide to these people. We are still closed, so the business are now start to be open, but very, very slowly, because he is very much concerned on how the numbers of places in the hospital that we have. The situation in Salvador and in Bahia, the state, is not that bad as the situation is in northeast of Brazil or north of Brazil and in São Paulo. And I believe this is exactly because of these measures that were taken. So close the schools, but the meals for in the public school is something very important. So provide all families with students in the public schools with the same meal that they would have at school. And then, so he created a program. It was called Salvador for All. It was, I think the population adopt very well this guidance of staying at home and trying to wear masks. That is something compulsory at that stage. And we are now at 3 months of that. So businesses are starting to pressure to open.
Yeah, no, that's a good. We'll come back to that because I think there's some interesting dynamics. I just want to explore. You both of you have already raised the variations between the national and then the state and then the city as well, which, you know, we can. I'd be very keen to just explore those in a bit more detail. But Katrin, you're representing Berlin and Germany on the call today, rather than necessarily kind of London and centre of the cities. But give us your reflections on, you know, how you've seen it play out in Berlin and Germany more generally.
Yeah, compared to the other places we've just heard of, I think the situation in Berlin was the whole time very much different, because from the beginning, there were literally not so many infections, and also the death rate was pretty low. So for sure, in the beginning, when we did not really know how the crisis would play out and how dangerous everything is and how many people are actually infected, there were more restrictions. But when we compare Berlin like with other places in Germany, given it is a capital with more than 3.7 million inhabitants, it has less people infected. For instance, only 217 cases per 100,000 inhabitants, compared to Bavaria with more than 350 cases per 100,000 inhabitants. So I think there were, like, for sure, contact restrictions in place, and in line with the other federal states, some regulations that shops are closed, etc. But from the point on, the federal states, as Berlin is, could decide on loosening and relaxing the lockdown rules. It really happened. And from Saturday on, basically, there won't be any contact restrictions anymore, meaning you're allowed to see as many people from as many different households as you wish. And I've been in Berlin so 1 month ago to see my family, because I'm also working from home. And I was in London before, and I could already see there the situation was pretty different. The bars, the cafes and restaurants were open, and for sure people keep their distance, and there you need to wear a face mask in supermarkets and in the public transport. But I would say life was pretty much back to normal. And also, I think when I know what has had happened in other cities, this extreme curfews, et cetera, that never happened in Berlin. So people, I would say, felt the whole time rather relaxed compared to other places.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, kind of the different circumstances. Sam, I'll come back to you, just because you hinted at it. We know, we observe that the relationship sometimes between the national government and the states and the cities is not as harmonious as maybe we would like it to be. But I mean,
a very diplomatic way to put it.
Quite. I mean, you know, I'll leave you to expand on that. But I mean, what's the pandemic kind of shone some lights on in terms of the sort of the power relations and the ways that these three types of government interact with each other and work with each other, or indeed not? I mean, what have we learned from this?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously at the national level, what we have going on in the US is just an extreme case of negligence, right? So it's so outsized that it's hard to even wrap your mind around the fact that the federal government here in the US has decided not to coordinate any of the pandemic response. You know, our president literally told everyone that he doesn't take responsibility for this, and that the states, the leaders of each state are on their own to organize, you know, supplies, to stockpile what they need, to organize the response, and of course also to set their own rules. So what that's led to is, you know, your experience of the pandemic in the US is going to vary quite dramatically depending on which state you live in. So in some states like California that moved very early to lock down, that, you know, the largest cities in California locked down the earliest, you know, they were able to keep the infection numbers down for quite some time because of that early action. And then in other states, you see, you know, it's particularly in Florida, Texas, Georgia, Arizona, the lockdowns did not last very long. The governors made a choice to open up very early. And now we're seeing the results of that, which is huge new spikes in cases in those states. So the disconnect between the federal government, the current administration in the U.S. and all of the states is quite profound. And quite unusual, it's all a result of who is currently in the White House and the extraordinary decisions that they've made not to really coordinate at all. But here in New York, I think the more interesting story is actually what the pandemic has further exposed between the relationship between New York City and the governor of our state, Andrew Cuomo. New Yorkers all know that the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, and the governor of our state, Mr. Cuomo, do not care for each other. This has been something that we've seen play out for the last 5+ years. Yeah. And it's really been not good for residents of the city. You've had the mayor and the governor not agreeing on what steps to take very publicly. You've had them contradicting each other. And you've had the governor step in and try to order the mayor to do, to put certain measures in place. There was a big fight about when and how to close the city parks, for example, where the governor was really pressuring the city to take steps that the city hadn't taken yet. So that disconnect has been even more visible, I would say, for most New Yorkers. Our governor has been having daily live press conferences up until just a week ago. He finally ended those. But every single day, 7 days a week, very visible. While the mayor has, there are quite a few calls at this point for our mayor to resign. Most of that is the result of how he handled the recent wave of protests in New York, but it started before then too. He managed to kind of embarrass himself several times by, for instance, there was a story about he decided to man the city's call center himself for an hour or two and take calls from residents to give them advice about, what the right thing to do is in their circumstances. And there was a story about someone calling in and he gave them bad advice. He told them they didn't need to quarantine, even though they had come into contact with someone who had tested positive for COVID. And, so there were too many stories like that about the mayor kind of bungling things and really doing a poor job communicating a consistent message about how to stay safe. So in that respect, many New Yorkers started turning to the governor for clearer advice. But that dynamic, the relationship between these two local leaders has been, not good. Yeah. And I would say everybody's given them low marks for their inability to coordinate.
And just to round that off, I mean, in terms of to what extent can the governor ultimately tell or make the city mayor do what the governor wants him? I mean, in a sense, where does the final power reside? Is it with the mayor of the city or with the governor?
It's a great question. In a lot of areas, in fact, it does lie with the governor. For example, in New York, the entire transit system here in New York City, so the subway system, the buses, everything to do with public transportation, in fact, is under the control of the governor, which is an unusual arrangement in the United States, but it is the fact, it is the case here in New York that that's how it works. So in terms of setting rules, New York City's subway system famously operates 24 hours a day, but it hasn't been for quite some time now because they've been closing down at night to clean all the trains. And that's a decision that the governor could make without the mayor's consent. Another thing is, ultimately the Constitution of New York State does allow for a governor to, it's never happened, but to remove a mayor if he so chooses. So there is a bit of leverage there. But there are obviously many decisions that were made at the city level. And I think the criticism is that a lot of the decisions that were made at the city level were in hindsight or even at the moment, not the right ones.
And it raises an interesting point. When I was talking to Lena Liaku a few weeks ago from the Global Cities Resilience Network, she was saying that, the relationships you have with different interests are important before something like this happens. And if they're not robust, going in, it's very difficult to build them whilst you're in it, but also if you're not robust going in, they cause you
problems. Listeners can't see me nodding emphatically, but it's no surprise to any New York City residents that our mayor and our governor don't see eye to eye frequently. So this was not a great situation to be in going into a crisis like this.
No, fantastic. Adriana, let's turn to you. So in a similar sort of question, really, about, you know, what's been revealed about the relationships and the power between, you know, the federal on the one hand, the state, and then obviously the cities themselves through the crisis. What has it revealed to us?
You know that the president of Brazil, he's inspired a lot in the president of the United States. So he mimics a lot what Donald Trump does. So he denied totally what was going on. And we have now a month without a minister of health. So there is a secretary who is a military guy coordinating that. And the pandemic is not in his agenda anyway. So what started to happen? It was mayors and government said they have to do something. Different from New York, the governor and the mayor of Salvador, they were always from opposite and totally opposite political parties, and they never gel together. But at the very beginning of this crisis, they came together, and it was surprise. For me, it was a big surprise first. And then it's amazing to see how both of them, they put the public interest above all of us, all of all these things, above political issues, and we're gonna have elections, municipal election this year. We might have, so we're still discussing if you're gonna have the election postponed or not. But this is the electoral year. And actually they are collaborating. And I think it's a very good example of how to deal with civic matters. And of course they are in the opposite direction that the federal government is going. So they are kind of together, all governors and mayors from one side, independent of the political party, and the federal government, they're isolated, thinking about their own agenda and their own problems that it's not COVID at the moment.
So as the crisis, you know, it's opened up or further deepened, you know, divisions and tensions between, you know, cities and states and the government, what would be your take?
I think open up the division between the federal government and his followers and the entire country. I would not say the rest of the country. I think it's entire country, you know?
Yeah.
And there is something interesting, crazy happening for more than a month now. Every Sunday, the followers and supporters of President Bolsonaro, they are going to the streets to manifest in favor of the governor, and also saying bad things about the Supreme Tribunal of Justice as well. And so some groups supporting democracy, they are always also going to the streets as well. And pretty much every Sunday, we have some kind of manifestation and not violent conflict action, actually, but some kind of manifestation, and the police is there to confirm and to maintain the order and, you know, to put down the violence. Mm. You know that everything that happens in the US resonates very much in Brazil. So in Salvador, it's a city with 8% of the population is African Brazilian. So what happened regarding to racism in the US resonates very much here. And we had in the same week, or pretty much every week, we had something similar like that. Yeah. So now these issues are, you know, people are starting to talking about these issues.
Well, I wonder, I'll come back onto that, because I think, I mean, again, really interesting area, if you just to reflect on what, you know, what the more recent sort of Black Lives Matter's agenda is, you know, how that's playing out. But Katrin, Germany's leader is slightly less controversial, let me say that, or considerably less controversial than maybe the US's and Brazil's. But just again, just, you know, think about what's it telling us about the relationship between the national and the states and then the cities themselves. What are we seeing through COVID that we maybe didn't see before, or we did see, but we can see it more clearly now?
In the beginning of the crisis, really Germany has seen the whole crisis is a big, big stress test for federalism, because the two areas which are now mostly in focus, health and education, are actually not the power or the competences of the national government. So all the 16 Länders we have in Germany are responsible for health and education and a lot of other things. So the German Minister of Health, he can give recommendations or advice, but he cannot forbid gatherings. The same for the education Minister of Education. She cannot say the lender or anyone has to close the schools. So far, I think all stakeholders are pretty happy with the results, because already very much in the beginning, all the 16 lenders came together to set up a kind of agenda. What are the minimum rules we need to introduce that the pandemic is under control? So very basic things in the beginning, contact restrictions, minimum distance, no gatherings, etc. And then this were the basics. And then the federal states could decide for themselves how strict they could become. For instance, I said in the beginning, Bavaria was very much affected compared to Berlin. Also, the economic structure is pretty different. So in Bavaria, a lot of manufacturing, whereas in Berlin, actually a lot of people can work from home. And so Bavaria went from the beginning a much stricter approach than Berlin. And compared to other places, it's the same. And in the beginning, the fun thing was there was a kind of race between the different federal states who would implement the harder restrictions. But now in the end, it's just the other way around. I think in the beginning of May, it has been introduced or decided by all lenders together that actually the restriction can be loosened. And now is a race about who is loosening the first and who's allowing the most. And I think it's normal that the federal states are cooperating with each other. And there's always always an argument. It's normal. So I think it has not really revealed something we would not have known before. I think it just has been proved that it's good to have actually a local approach. And so the only local approach they did with regard to the lifting was that they introduced a kind of break. So each federal state can now lift the lockdown as he thinks it's the best for the local area. But there's one rule, which is like, if there have been 50 new infections during the last week, there must be intervention at the very local level. But this is then the municipality who's taking over the action. So in cooperation with the federal state. A good example, I think, for that is what we've just seen in North Rhine-Westphalia. There was an outbreak, a sudden outbreak in a meat manufacturing company, 1,500 people infected. So in exactly this county area has now been introduced a local lockdown, which is almost as tough as in the beginning of the crisis. So when everyone was like really overwhelmed by the situation, but this does just apply for this local area. And as I think we have the institutions in place, this can be just rolled out. Schools have to close. There's the health agency is in high alert and everything, but for the rest of the country or even the federal state, it has not really any implications.
That's interesting, Summer, because in a sense, what seems to be there going on is that the states are, you know, working together as a collective. Yes, they're relating to and talking to the national government, but actually they're collectively working together, you know, to figure out what needs to be done. But my sense from what you were saying and what you know, what I observe and read is that the states, at least not all, you know, not all of them at least, are, you know, are coming together to do that. Is that right, or are we missing something there? What's the sense that the states across the country are, you know, actively collaborating and working together?
And they have to work together anyways, because a large part of our national laws, we do need the confirmation of the federal states. So right, they're all working together.
Yeah, that's interesting. Some sort of reflection on that from the US point of view.
Yeah, so what we've seen are kind of regional coalitions of states here in the US. So a number of states in the northeast part of the country decided to band together in order to, you know, order supplies together in order to coordinate their openings so that we could work in concert as a region. The same thing has happened in the western part of the US. There's a coalition of states that are coordinating their responses. But that's all really just happened somewhat organically at the behest of those governors. Those structures were not in place beforehand. It was very ad hoc, although I think welcome by all residents in those regions where you see that coordination between the states. But it was all just kind of invented through the course of this particular crisis, because the different states in the U.S. were in fact competing with one another for supplies, and it was driving prices up because the federal government absolutely refused to come in and help coordinate that process. So you had, you know, so many stories of governors, paying enormous prices for supplies, including masks, including ventilators, including gloves and other kinds of protective gear, where they were paying well above normal rates for those supplies. And then even in some cases, ending up with supplies that were not up to standards, that they would overspend and then get useless supplies as a result. So the governors really decided in those coalitions to take it upon themselves to reach out to each other and start to coordinate, because it was clear to all of them that the situation wasn't working for anyone.
Now, that's interesting. Adriana, the extent to which the states and the cities are sort of forming coalitions or forming collaborations almost because of, rather in spite of, rather than because of, you know, what's going on at the country level. Is that an experience you've seen? Is that happening?
Yes. The state government, they came together, especially by region, because Brazil is a big country. So the governors from the northeast region, they got together to buy to the northeast states. The governors from the south or the southeast, they got together to do the binds in that way. So I think it was more practical and more efficient.
Okay, so let's move on to economic recovery, I suppose. Katrin, maybe start with you. Just, can you give us a sense as to, you know, where the thinking is? I mean, use Berlin as an example, but where the city is in terms of the recovery phase, and then are we seeing, you know, packages of support and activity beginning to be rolled out? I mean, how would you characterize the recovery phase in Berlin at the minute, Katrin?
Yeah, I mean, as Ari said, we are pretty much in the way of recovery because basically all shops, restaurants are open. But I mean, for sure there are challenges. I mean, Berlin has a very specific economic structure, which is very much oriented on like all these retail hotels dependent on tourism. So I think it did not suffer so much during the financial crisis because the financial center of Germany is in Frankfurt. But now there is supposedly a large effect, even though the restaurants, etc., open, there are still restrictions in place and tourists are not coming. So this is like the local economic structure. I haven't heard of any measure just for Berlin. I think the cities in Germany facing all the problem that the major source of income is the business tax, and this will be for sure very much reduced for this year. And there is like one measure which is set up by the government to tackle this. So they will apparently come up for all the revenues from the income tax. So this is like something particularly focused for municipalities. But I mean, the majority of programs or measures are like targeting the whole of the country and are not very specific targeting one local area. It's like basically infrastructure, like all green for the Deutsche Bahn, but for sure also support for single businesses. But there is definitely no local aspect at this point.
Interesting. Samuel, I come to you. I mean, the destruction of the tax base. I've seen some of the numbers from the New York Comptroller's office in terms of the, you know, what's happened to the tax base is just staggering in terms of numbers. It reminds us, you know, in a more devolved federal system, you are much more reliant on the, you know, on your tax revenues for, you know, for paying for public services and such. But just, I mean, where's the economic recovery currently in New York? I mean, that you know, you said the economy is beginning to open up again. What's the city and the state? What are they doing in addition to, you know, opening up? Are they putting together support packages?
So the state and the city have been providing unemployment benefits, right? So, but those benefits are quite small. So the one thing that our national government managed to do to help the country was some months ago when they passed the Congress passed the CARES Act, which bumped up unemployment benefits for the vast majority of the country. So the issue now is that those additional benefits, it's an extra $600 a week. So it's not nothing. And it in fact has helped quite a few lower income families across the whole country are suddenly no longer below the poverty line. There's been some recent data suggesting that quite a few families are in fact slightly better off now financially than they were before the crisis. But those benefits are set to expire in July. And there's currently no appetite at the national level to extend those benefits or find more ways to get cash into the pockets of families who have lost their jobs. But at the local level, you know, it's not the mechanisms to help in terms of unemployment benefits are, you know, they're fairly small. And what we're seeing is that, you know, so city governments in the U.S. are required to run balanced budgets. They can't deficit spend the way that the national government can. Yeah. So, the sales tax receipts, the all of the kind of revenue that the city itself normally depends on has just evaporated. And we're seeing this in every city. Every city in the U.S. is now facing the possibility of moving into an austerity mode because they cannot proceed unless their budget is balanced. And it's also budgeting season, or it has been. So what we're finding is cities all over the U.S. are revising their budgets and introducing huge cuts. And the problem with that is that we know from the 2008 recession that the same kinds of measures were put in place, and it made the recession worse. Economists largely agree on the reality that putting in, you know, dramatically cutting city services, you know, contributing to unemployment numbers because the civil service at the local level has been decimated, it doesn't help. So the states and the cities are still hoping, I think, for more assistance from the national government. And, you know, all signals are that they're not going to get it. So I think what we're facing is very soon a massive austerity crisis at the local level across the U.S. It hasn't happened yet. But it's clear that it's coming, and I think economists are very worried that this is only going to make the economic part of the crisis worse.
Yeah, not quite. Well, you touch on, you know, the loads of the different issues there, but in a sense, you know, the in some respects, as horrendous and horrific as it was, the short-term interventions on the health side and particularly on the economy side to shore up the economy, as difficult and as large as they've been, they are relatively straightforward to introduce, at least. It's the recovery phase, you know, the phase in, the time in, the nature, where it gets awfully more complicated and, by very nature, much more political about how you do those and what you don't do and what you should do. So it's a very good point. Adriana, just give us a sense as to how, you know, where's Salvador in terms of economic recovery? And just carry on this, particularly pick up this point about the tax base and the significance of it for you in terms of, you know, more generally public services to allow the city to open up and to function again.
Well, the idea that the public service probably will open again in a month or two In terms of benefits, the federal government, they put some benefits for lots of Brazilians and create a digital ID, because these people, they were not, how can I say, seen, because they didn't use to pay tax. So they were not in the system. But then it was created in an app, a system to create a digital ID, and these people were able to assess these benefits. The city also put some benefit for informal workers and people, vulnerable people who got COVID as well. There is a big concern with these informal workers and with small business. So I think the main concern is with small business, because they are the first, you know, to suffer. And there is an agent for small business in Brazil. It's a federal one. And they start work very close with the small business to see how can they change their business, how can go digital, how can learn quickly about marketing tools and keep them working. So it was something done nationally. And here in the city, we actually create a guidance for a small business. So explain, what is Instagram? How can you, very basic and simple things, but how can you sell using Instagram? What can you do? What are the cheapest money that you might find now? How can you organize your finance? So pretty much things related to mentoring and guidance for a small business. The resilience office with the Global Resilient Cities, we had already some open call to incubate solutions, and then we bring this to the context of COVID. It is it's open at the moment, and it's with money of the Inter-American Bank, and so non-repayable money, and for women. So we have these, it's a very small initiative at the moment, but it's a way to support business. And there are some open calls trying to support small business for many, many institutions. They are doing that at the moment. So how can they help small business with a small amount of money? We are still working on a recovery pack. So the idea at the moment, the city is working on protocols to open slowly the shops and the business. Not all businesses, the shops are not open at the moment. So we're creating protocols, so how to act, how to conduct. And I think after that, we will come out with some kind of a recovery pack.
Fantastic.
Having said that, it's going to be very hard, because the economy of Brazil, yesterday I saw on the news that last month has shrunk 9% already.
Yeah.
So it's a lot.
We begin to come to a close, but that touches on my final sort of question, or to get your reflection on it. I get asked this quite a lot, and I don't think I have a good answer yet. So in part, I'm just asking you to hear what you've got to say, and then I'll plagiarize as appropriate. But I mean, you know, what's your medium term take on, you know, New York and Berlin and Salvador, you know, in a sense of, if we think about, you know, these places and why they've become dynamic, you know, prosperous, vibrant places over the last two decades and or beyond, you know, about bringing people together, bringing firms together, density, proximity, you know, creativity, all of those things that we know massively important for businesses, for workers, and for, you know, for the cities themselves. Are we at a kind of a fundamental moment of rethink, or do you think this is, you know, this is a moment in time, but actually, you know, it's part of an evolving process that your cities are going through? Summer, you give us the sort of, what's your medium term prognosis for New York? I hate these questions when they get asked of me, but as I'm the asker, I can do it and ignore the fact that you probably go, that's a terrible
really
question.
Putting me on the spot.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. I mean, if I had to guess, I think we're going to see a huge problem for small businesses in the service sector, particularly restaurants, which, you know, are now being allowed to slowly reopen, but only at 50% capacity, which, as anybody who's ever worked in a restaurant knows, is just doesn't make any sense for the restaurant model, right? Like the margins are too low. It's not really going to work long term. So you're going to see, I think you're going to see a large number of small businesses close permanently in the medium term in New York City, which is not going to help the tax revenue problem at the city level either. And then I think you're also going to see very likely some residents who fled at the beginning of the pandemic may not come back right away or ever. And that's already starting to put some downward pressure on rents. So that might be a good thing. The cost of living in New York City has been very, very high for quite some time. I do know a lot of long-term, lifelong New York residents who are kind of rooting for a little bit of a readjustment. It might be nice if it was a little bit cheaper to live in the city. But, you know, if there are not as many amenities, if the local economy is not as good as it was, will people want to stay? I think definitely the attractions and appeals of, you know, of dense urban life, there are always going to be people who want to live that way and who will stick it out. And then there are people who don't have another option, right? They can't afford to relocate. They don't know have any other place to go. I think it's going to be a very different economy for quite some time in New York City. You know, what exactly that looks like. It might be a little bit cheaper to live in New York, but there might be fewer bars and restaurants than there used to be for a while.
Yeah, and that's a good, very good point. And as you say, the how one decision affects another decision, if people leave, which, you know, actually downward pressure on rents, but then actually is a loss of revenues and such, which then, you know, has implications for public services, which, you know, then feed back into other decisions that people are making.
Exactly.
Yeah. Catherine, give us your kind of medium term for Berlin. Again, a very similar urban services dominated place. You know, the buzz of living in Berlin has been a prominent theme for its revival over the last 10 or so years. Likely to continue or not?
It's a very difficult question. And I would say for sure, the hospitality sector is affected, but still the city was not facing the same problems as other cities before. I mean, it is not an economically very strong city, so there are companies, but the public sector, for instance, is very strong there. For sure, these workers are all working from home, but I'm very sure that they will return at a certain point. Then we have a large group of people working in tech and startups. They basically settled down there to be in Berlin, so I highly doubt that they will suddenly locate somewhere else, because they were locating there due to rents, due to the whole ambience. So I think, in the medium term, hospitality tourism will be affected. But given the economic structure and the circumstances, Berlin as a place to live, I think won't be affected. And I know the working from home discussion is always very strong. But generally, in Germany, you don't work from home. So partly people work from home, but I think this crisis won't have like a large impact, meaning that people would suddenly start working from home. For sure, more people will work from home during the week, but it won't lead to a change of the city. So this is my prediction.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So Adriana, same question to you. Give us the kind of medium term outlook for Salvador.
For the midterm, I think you're going to struggle a lot. Salvador is a tourist city. Carnival is a big source of income, and as the new year, so we won't have for the next year. So I think the city will have to reinvent the way of doing business and tourism. One thing that might happen is we start trying to get more value for things that we have here, our identity, our culture, and maybe start to think about a tourism of proximity, not to bring, you know, people from abroad so much, but maybe bring people from closed cities. So I think we, as a society and as humanity, we need to rethink how we do many, many things, and especially how we are doing business. I think the levels of consumerism, it needs to go down. I think we need to go more to the basics and maybe for what is more essential, actually.
Such a rich conversation. My guests today have been Summer Mathis, Adriana Compello, and Catherine Henkel. Thank you very much for being part of City Talks. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.